Dream Hampton, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So it occurred to me that your joining MOCAD makes perfect sense, as your career has been what seems to be this perfect symbiotic relationship between art and activism. Can you talk about how you've been able to strike the balance between those two, and if ever one has been the leader over the other?
Yeah, I mean, great question, because the truth is there isn't really balance. They're two beyond full-time jobs. They take up, both of them, 200% of your time. And so there have been absolute gaps when I look at my life, and which is also my career. I don't know that there's a big distinction. I kind of do what I love, and therefore it's my life. And there are whole years when all I was doing, even recently, I was living in Los Angeles, splitting my time between Los Angeles and Detroit, and I found myself working on two different props, props 47 and 64. And they were my first time doing activism that was connected to actual legislation. One was about changing felonies to the misdemeanors that they should have always been. And the other one was about the legalization and the economic equity issues connected to the legalization of marijuana. And learned so much doing both of those legislations, but I wasn't at that same time also making art. It was when I told my partner in that work, hey, I'm so glad we got these two props passed. I need to go and do, you know, some film now, make some art. And then I went and made three film and TV projects, Surviving R. Kelly, one of them. So if I started working on those three films in 2018, I would say from 2014 to 2018, I was just working on legislation. So I don't have a balance. I kind of go in between. It's a toggle.
It's so funny. So the last time I saw you, and I was interviewing you just about your career, in the in-between moments while you were waiting for, you know, us to get set up and all of that, I remember you were on some sort of like activism call, and I was like, oh, how does this woman find the time for all this incredible stuff? But then, you know, it kind of reminds me of Denzel Washington. I once heard him say that, like, he makes the equalizer so that he can make fences, and that he kind of goes back and forth between the films he wants to make and the films that make him a lot of money so that he can make those films. And when it comes to balance, do you have to kind of strike that balance of doing the things that are meaningful to you and make money, but that give you the space to work on things that don't pay the bills at all?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that I just do the work that's in front of me and hope that it pays the bills. And if it doesn't, then I just don't have cable. You know, like, I'm a working class girl from the east side of Detroit. So I probably don't need as much money as Denzel does, you know, to live. And I also have realized, just thinking how quickly time has passed, I realize how short life is. And so when you do something that has some success, like Surviving R. Kelly, and I did, again, three projects that year, two of which I'm very proud of, but hardly anyone saw. So you have this one project out of three that people saw, and it gets you all these meetings. I don't then look at these new opportunities as, you know, what's going to be my payday and what's going to be what I care about. Because I think that life is short, I'm only going to do the stuff that I care about. The three films that I did in 2018, one was shot in an Indiana prison, and the guys inside were the directors. It was called It's a Hard Truth, Ain't It? It was on HBO. The other was, you know, another six-part docuseries that was on BET called Finding Justice. And I cared deeply about all three of those projects, including Surviving R. Kelly. But only one of them, you know, had some kind of payday. And the payday wasn't financial. It was just that people saw it. And then there was impact. But I would say the other two had their own impact, too. So I don't know. My measurement for success is pretty, again, I don't know if it's tempered by my working class, like, roots. But I don't know. I've known people, weirdly, even though I'm from the east side of Detroit. I was really young when I started meeting millionaires and some of them who went on to be billionaires. And they're not, like, happier than me on my best days. So I don't connect that to wealth. I grew up in Detroit when, like, a lot of my friends were dealing drugs. They had a ton of money. So I've been in every fancy car you can be in. So I don't need a fancy car. I have a Volkswagen. I don't know. I'm okay.
So when we're talking about things that you make space and time for, regardless of you know, the payday, when it comes to then MOCAD and taking this on, what are you hoping to bring to the board or to help shift at MOCAD?
Well, I mean, first of all, I was actually honored. I know this sounds like something that people say, but I was super honored to be invited. I love what they have been trying to do there. And for me, that reach can be just as important as whether or not they reach their goal, you know? I've seen them bring in amazing people as curators. One of the very first shows that I saw there, Visions in a Cornfield, blew my socks off. It's definitely one of the best shows I've seen in the past 10, 15 years. And so I'm actually honored to, like, you know, be a part. I remember them also making missteps from the beginning. Remember they had that sign, you were probably still at WDET and had to pass it every day, that said, mm-hmm. nothing is going to be all right or something.
It's like, it's all going to be all right or, yeah.
No, it was nothing is going to be all right.
Is that right?
It was the first sign. Yeah. And so community was like, are you friggin' kidding me? We don't need your your dystopic irony or your Tim Burton vibes. So they changed it. They changed the sign. And I remember being, wow, they were actually responsive to community. I'm not sure that would have happened in New York. New York would have just kept on being, you know, droll and ironic or whatever they were going for. And so, you know, that kind of responsiveness to community, I'm not saying it's always been there. I'm not saying they've always met community demands. And I'm not saying that my joining the board is going to improve that, but it'll be one of the things as a board member that I'm looking at is how, as you build an institution in Detroit, which MOCAD is certainly going to be, how can you be accountable to community?
That's so interesting. My memory had skipped right over the nothing will be all right sign.
Do you remember it now?
Or yes, because I just looked it up and I said yes. Because they changed it, and you're absolutely right.
They changed it because people said, are you kidding me?
Right.
It was like 07 or 08. Things were like really, you know, it was, of course, we felt the first, you know, global crisis, financial crisis before the rest of the world did. And yeah, it just wasn't a message that people wanted to see every day. And they responded and changed it. And I remember thinking, that's interesting.
What do you think is the art or artist or even institution's role in being responsive to the world around it and what the world demands of art?
Well, I mean, this is a question that is happening across the country and across the world, right? You have groups like Decolonize, just all kinds of different groups that are popping up that are asking important questions of museums. Because it turns out that more people visit museums than almost any other place in the country. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was surprising. It was way more than amusement parks, than sports stadiums, and it could be these mandatory trips that our kids go on, but it turns out, and it's true though for me too, when I travel the world, I go to a museum. And I grew up going to the DIA, and it's where I discovered a love first for Diego Rivera and then for just art in general, and learned different canons, and whether it's ancient or modern or postmodern. And so I remember just being exposed as a teenager to everything that the DIA had to offer. In fact, I became a filmmaker from watching weird art films at the DFT, you know, when I was in ninth grade. And so I know how important these spaces are. And I just know that, yeah, there's a worldwide conversation. Some of it is about repatriating works that were stolen that were pillaged during colonization and war. And these are ongoing questions. These aren't just ancient ones. Certainly you have places like Greece or Nigeria saying, hey, give us back our stuff. And these conversations are deeply interesting to me. And then you have stories like, you know, some of our post-recent post-wars, where you have, you know, soldiers in Arkansas who stole something out of some ancient Mesopotamian thing out of a rock. Like, so there are interesting conversations that are happening around art, provenance, activism. They're all happening right now. And it's an interesting place to take a peek if you're interested at all.
Dream, you became a national name with your byline on some really big profiles of rappers in the mid-1990s, and you also counted some of hip-hop's biggest names as colleagues or friends at the time. People still call you one of the most important hip-hop journalists to put words to the genre, but it's not an accolade that I've known you to love. And I'm just interested in asking you about why this recognition lands with you in a funny or frustrating place.
Well, I don't know. I was in film school when I started writing. Some of it is that it's an overdescription, right? I get described as like the first woman editor of The Source. And while that's true, I was the photo editor and then the assistant editor. Kim Osaria was the first editor in chief, and that's probably what they mean. I was at The Source for 18 months when I was 19. I wrote for Vibe for another 10 years, but I don't think I ever went into their office. And I certainly wasn't as prolific. Those props can just go to someone else, is all I'm saying. Like, there are people who actually care. I certainly, hip hop right now, and not just right now. Like, I've never listened to a whole Kanye West album. I'm sure they're good. I remember hearing pieces of 808 that were amazing.
Are you sure they were good?
I'm sure. I think maybe. I know that I don't think he can rap, but I didn't think Tupac could rap. And so, therefore, if you're hearing this and that's offensive to you, you can just say, well, she doesn't know anything about hip hop anyway. And you're right, I don't. So that settles that.
Well, I've been thinking about you a lot lately because I realized for myself that it's a lot harder for me to listen to hip hop and rap that I used to love because the messages are so dismissive of women. I find myself now searching for more empowered female MCs in a way that I never did maybe 5 or 10 years ago. Do you reflect differently on the art of people who you came up with, whose messages you don't always love?
Well, I mean, I'm proud to say that I handled it then, you know? It's not an afterthought for me. I was self-identifying as a feminist by the time I started doing that work at 19. I'd already, you know, begun reading bell hooks and been thinking about misogyny and art, and whether I'm looking at Picasso's work where he's literally rearranging women that he's also in real life terrorizing, or I'm looking at, you know, Treat Her Like a Prostitute by Slick Rick, an MC that I love. Tribe Called Quest, their date rape song. I remember us taking on a Tribe Called Quest back in the day. I mean, the first thing I ever wrote at The Source, for instance, when I was 19, was an article about Dr. Dre physically assaulting Dee Barnes. And I had death threats from death row. So I think that, you know, one of the things that's been amazing about Me Too is to learn, you know, yes, like maybe this starts with some Hollywood women sharing their stories, and maybe those Hollywood women are only B-list, and then the A-listers like Gwyneth and Angelina come out. And then immediately there was this pivot that I was grateful that Time's Up did, you know, to say janitors in California. And so what we learned from Me Too in those early days of the hashtag and people using that hashtag to nest their own testimonies around trauma and just everyday misogyny, casual or violent, all of it is violent, but casual or like super, you know, whatever the spectrum would be, we found that it's everywhere. You know, that is actually the story of Me Too. But what we learned early in Me Too is that we don't have to look at something as outrageous as hip hop or rock and roll. We could obviously do the same thing with music from any genre in the 80s and 90s. You could find misogyny, but we can look at it in every aspect of our life, which I knew then too. You know, I knew that the first time that I heard that women were bitches and hoes wasn't on a Snoop Dogg record, but it was in church, where I learned the binary of Madonna and the whore.
That's so interesting. So how do we determine what is a forgivable sin, maybe, of an artist versus a transgression that's so egregious that we have to, like, completely cleanse ourselves of the art as well? On that extreme, R. Kelly would be a pretty great example, although many people have not cleansed themselves of his art. How do you make that distinction?
Yeah, it's hard for me. I love R. Kelly's music, so I get it. I'm not here to be the referee around that. I included the women who began the Mute R. Kelly campaign in the documentary, but I didn't start the Mute R. Kelly campaign. I'd already failed back then that, you know, very young dream who was reading Pearl Clegg, of course, from Detroit, playwright and author. Her father was Reverend Clegg, who started the Shrine of the Black Madonna. And she wrote an incredible kind of chap-sized book called Mad at Miles, when Quincy Troops's Miles Davis autobiography came out. And he was gleefully or just completely unrepentantly talking about physically abusing women like Cicely Tyson. And what Pearl Clegg was calling for in the book Mad at Miles, it was about boycotting his music. And when you have someone like R. Kelly, who, when you buy his concert ticket or when you are supporting his music with money, you are helping to tie women to radiators, then there's something that you can do about it, you know? I also think that there's, you know, Detroit has been leading in terms of social justice, leading practices around restorative justice and transformative justice. And I think those are important too, you know? I remember calling in Too Short instead of calling him out. He'd made some ridiculous video for some rap site about how to corner a girl on the playground and smooch her booty. It was like an instruction video for eighth grade boys on how to sexually assault their classmates. And I got him on the phone and just, you know, kind of went in on him for like an hour. And he just really didn't even understand that what he was describing was sexual assault. And he wasn't young. This is like, you know, 10 years ago.
He saw it as something like playful interactions between boys and girls.
Yeah, and I had to let him know what it was like going to public pools, like growing up in Detroit, you know, being at Chandler Park or Belle Isle, and, you know, what was considered playful and what was absolutely sexual assault, you know? And so, you know, we had that conversation, and that, I'm not saying that Too Short is some changed man or that calling him in was better than calling him out. I published that article, so it was a call in and call out at the same time. I too have been, you know, there's a whole new generation that calls things abuse that I didn't consider abuse before. And I have been called out in that way. I haven't been called in. With this generation, you learn about it when people post about it. They don't like come to you directly. They're like conflict averse, and then they blow up on the internet. But even that model of never having someone come to you with their problems about you has still been instructive to me. I've still been able to learn things. Once you get past the ego bruising of being called out, then you have to look at the charges and then separate things that you can't own to things that you can, and then work on them. And I wish more people were interested in that. You know, it's hard work, though.
To that end, you know, you've mentioned Picasso a couple times, and I'm just curious, when you look at a Picasso, do you see something horrendous or something beautiful or maybe something far more nuanced than that?
Yeah, both. I mean, again, I'm from Detroit, and, you know, like Berlin, this is what one would call like a masculine city. It's not beautiful. It's not Paris. It's not, you know, it's not even San Francisco. Like, it's not even Chicago with its incredible architecture. You know, Detroit is rough looking, but I've always found beauty in it. So when I look at Picasso, I see a lot of things. I see the African art that was influencing him that largely went unsighted by critics and by himself, even though he talked about it to a bit. But more than that, I see him rearranging these women who we know that he just, you know, abused, at least psychologically. He took like great glee in it, like a Scorpio would. But I don't know why I'm talking about Picasso. I'm not some Picasso expert, and I don't know everything there is to know about Picasso. But I know that when we hold out particular people as examples of like terrible behavior, I just try to remind folks that the people that we hold up as the height of, you know, artistic accomplishment are also going to present these kinds of problems.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking now with Dream Hampton. She's a Detroit native, a filmmaker, an art and culture critic, a woman of many hats, I would say. So let's talk a little bit about then Detroit Narrative Agency, the idea of disrupting harmful narratives about Detroit, a community of filmmakers doing this. What are the most harmful narratives that you'd like to eradicate as a filmmaker?
I think that some of them sound benign, you know. My work isn't necessarily completely focused in Detroit. Of course, Treasure was a documentary that I did about Shelley Hilliard. But the work of Detroit Narrative Agency was thinking about things that, again, seemingly benign as Detroit is back, you know, which is why you see people wearing T-shirts that said Detroit never left. Because implicit in all of those conversations, like everything with Detroit, is this weird race, you know, this narrative that now that white people are moving back to the city, it's somehow back, that everything in between was this dead space. And Detroit in the 80s, there's nowhere else I'd rather be. It was incredibly vibrant. I felt powerful. I remember moving to New York in 1990 and bemoaning the lack of like black civic leadership. I remember David Dinkins in my second year in New York was up for mayor, and everyone was so excited that they were getting to vote for the very first time in New York's history for a black mayor. And I'm like, what? Like, that's all we have in Detroit, until, of course, we didn't. And so, you know, I remember feeling quite empowered growing up in Detroit. And in the absence of, like, you know, being in an all-black city meant that in the absence of that kind of racial discord, I mean, you can find some racial discord, you just had to go to the suburbs to do it. We had to deal with stuff like class, you know, like, again, when I say I'm from the East Side, that means something. It means that I'm from, like, the poorest neighborhood, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country. And when I went to Cass Tech, all of a sudden I was in school with people whose parents were lawyers and doctors or engineers at Chrysler. And then I just realized, you know, something that, you know, Americans never want to deal with, which is like a class conversation. And so, I don't know, that's one thing about Detroit. Detroit is back, has implicit in it, and DNA, you know, knows this and identifies it and talks about it in their work when they do presentations as a collective of their films. And their films don't necessarily deal with issues like gentrification, but the need to create a Detroit narrative agency was to push back against Detroit as a blank slate, Detroit as a city where other people needed to drop in, whether it was someone from Time magazine or the filmmakers who made that wonderful film, Jesus Camp, and then came to Detroit and made a not-so-great film. You know, just the whole kind of, like, parachute in because there's no one there to tell their own stories, which was never true. We've always been a city of storytellers and artists.
There's been, especially I think in the past few years, a real push to make sure that Detroiters and Black Detroiters specifically are the artists that are leading the way in telling the narrative of the city, rather than, as you say, somebody hijacking that narrative. Do you think that that the move to ensure that Detroit's artists are at the forefront is a successful one?
I hope that it is, and I know that there are curators. You know, I think of Jova at MOCAD, who are working to make it so, who are making sure that, you know, there are shows up with people like Sterling Tolles or Brie Gant, you know, just to put those local artists, you know, to the fore. We also have always been an international city, you know, as provincial as we seem sometimes. I mean, we know that, you know, techno happened because there was a conversation between, you know, people who are making music here and people who are making music in Germany. So, like, we are always, you know, looking out into the world and you know, doing it through our own lens. But DNA has a show right now at MOCAD. I think about Vanessa Reynolds' work and different people who are local, who are really leading the way in a really organic way.
Right. So you're in the city of Detroit now, and as you've mentioned, you have spent the past few years splitting your time between various cities, including Los Angeles, and I'm sure New York in there as well, if not other cities to do your film projects. What keeps you coming back to the city of Detroit?
Well, I made a real decision to come home in about 07, 08. My daughter was about to be an age where she would, if we were living in Detroit or the Midwest, be learning how to drive. And we weren't. We were living in New York, where people at 50 years old don't know how to drive. So I remember thinking something as random as that, like, I really want my kid to have a Midwestern, you know, kind of teenage years. They can get super fast in New York. And so I made a decision to come home. Family stuff also brought me home. And I guess that's the bottom line. This is my home. And so when I think about the kind of childhood that I want to give my daughter, when I think about having to be close to family, you know, which isn't always, a lot of us, you know, particularly artists, you flee your hometown and your family, you know, they don't understand you and this place is too small for me. but then you, it's like, you know, it's like the White Stripes' little room, you know, you like, you're sitting there, you're dealing with whatever amount of success that you have. And you're like, wait, how do I get back to that thing that made me fresh? Or that made me me. And for me, that's Detroit. And so I'll always come home to Detroit. You know, I won a Kresge grant a couple years. And with that money, I was able to buy something here, which at the time I felt was like the best way to use that money. And I'm so happy that I did, because now I'm priced out of so much of Detroit. And that is a tragedy, too.
Do you still think that the city, I mean, getting back to what makes you fresh, right? Do you think the city influences you and your art still in everything you do?
Well, for sure. I'm definitely not conflict averse. Like some millennials and Gen Ys. They're not conflict averse. They just turn up in a different way, like not in your face. And so that, you know, so going to New York and like, say, taking on Dr. Dre at 20, was something that, of course, that's what you do. You know what I mean? This is Detroit, you know? So for me, growing up on the East Side very early on, I just had to learn to fight for what was right. I can remember the boys around the corner stealing my brother's bike and having to march around the corner and get it back from them. I can remember, like, you know, skate land and like the girls like protecting one another, also fighting one another. Like, I can, so all of these things shaped who I am. I don't always need to be fighting and scrappy in the world. I also learned how to live really well here. It was a really beautiful day yesterday, and I went to my favorite park in the whole world. I really like Hyde Park in London. There are a couple of places that I really love their parks. Mexico City has an incredible park, but Belle Isle is definitely the best park in the world to me. And that's like really good living to me, like to be able to spend a day driving 8 miles around an hour around the island of Belle Isle.
Dream Hampton is an Emmy-nominated filmmaker and the newest member of the board of MOCAD. Dream, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.